afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It is Saturday, December 20th, 2014. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. In the last 10 days or so, there have been a series of significant jolts, politically and economically, around the world that are propelling the world into a moment of truth in which either we in the U.S. remove Obama and proceed with a Hamiltonian reorganization of the financial system, or we'll find ourselves in World War III. Two processes in particular indicate that we are approaching such a punctum salience. First, in the United States, there was a very significant fight in the U.S. Congress over a provision that was tacked on to the so-called Cromnibus budget bill that would extend FDIC protection to banks engaging in risky derivatives trading. This became a fight which brought a certain amount of clarity to what has occurred since Obama became president in 2009, because Obama joined with the Republican leadership and with J.P. Morgan Chase's CEO, Jamie Dimon, to ram through this provision, which means that taxpayers will bail out speculators when their commodities bets go bad, which they will. But there was a fight, as Maxine Waters on the House side and Elizabeth Warren on the Senate side identified the real issue: Wall Street versus the people of the country. And in this fight in particular, Maxine Waters identified what she called the strange pairing of Obama and Jamie Dimon, which to listeners of this program is not strange at all. It's business as usual. Now, the other process involves the drive for war with Russia and what may appear on the surface to be financial warfare, the sanctions, the oil price drop, and so on. Underneath, it's really a push for regime change is becoming increasingly clear. In a press conference on Thursday, President Putin identified he identified regime change as the intent behind the attack on Russia. On today's program, we're going to bring further clarity to this rapidly changing arena of financial warfare to prepare you for the organizing responsibilities that you have, to work with Lyndon LaRouche and LaRouche PAC to break the United States from under the control of the London-centered empire and into collaboration with the BRICS process. Joining me to discuss this will be one of the financial intelligence directors of the Executive Intelligence Review and probably one of the best informed people on this kind of financial life and death issue, Paul Gallagher. And I should just warn you, Paul's joining us with he's slightly under the weather, but I'm sure he'll be up for the challenge. So, Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'll do my best.
Okay, well, let's begin by looking at the situation with Russia, because this is the most ominous, but it's also the one that very few people have a clue what's going on. There's a lot of triumphalism coming from London, Wall Street, from Obama, that the sanctions are working, Putin is being brought to his knees, blah, blah, blah. Well, what's the real situation at present, as far as you know?
Well, some of these oligarchs really have their heads in the clouds completely. I mean, I saw this statement by Roger Altman, one of the senior Wall Street figures. Russia is on its knees a few days ago. This is most definitely not the case. Russia is not taking the steps that, at least not yet, is not taking the steps that Lyndon LaRouche has called on them to take. And just to get it right on the table first, because this provides some clarity. I mean, you have to know in what direction you want to be going in order to develop a situation. They should be establishing capital controls. That means preventing or limiting, requiring justification for any export of capital out of the country and vice versa. They should be establishing currency controls. That means limiting the accounts held in foreign countries in Russia by banks, speculators, and so forth. And they should be taking steps to generate credit where there is none right now, not through the banks, but directly into the economy, national credit directly into the economy, in order to carry out in some cases start long postponed basic infrastructure projects across the country, like the planned high-speed rail that's eventually going to go from Moscow to Beijing, which is a partnership with the Chinese.
So, well, Paul, you said this has been LaRouche's proposal. There are some voices in Russia who are echoing this.
Yes. Sergei Glasyev, an advisor to Putin and an old friend of LaRouche, a Russia expert who is very well known there, Daisuke Kotagawa, the former IMF representative of Japan to the IMF, who's also very well known in Russia and also a friend of LaRouche, and others now in the president's party, the United Russia Party, are calling for what they call the Malaysia solution, because in 1998, when Malaysia was, when initially Thailand was attacked by George Soros and the other speculators, Thailand went the high interest rate route and destroyed its economy to try to defend its currency. Malaysia, under Mahathir, went the capital controls, exchange controls, and even controls on the repatriation of profits out of the country by foreign investors for a certain period of time, and its economy came through extremely well, when virtually every other one in Asia was really gouged very badly by that 1997-1998 crisis. So the Malaysia solution is being put forward, and Kotagawa, who is a figure who was really in the middle of that, although he was a Japanese official, he carried out the same kind of steps to stop speculation, currency speculation in Japan at the same time, and really knows whereof he speaks, had a forum in Moscow the other day with Glasyev. So there are, and they were very forceful, so there's a lot of discussion of what LaRouche proposes all over Russia, but they haven't done it yet. But they most certainly have no intention of going down on their knees or making concessions, political, strategic concessions over Ukraine, concessions over Crimea. They have no intention of doing that because of financial warfare, which Putin indicated in his speech the other, in his annual Q&A, I should say, the other day, which he does for 4 hours once a year, indicated very, very forcefully that his view is that this has been in preparation since the Soviet Union was dissolved. The destruction of Russia has been the target of the neocons and the British since that time, and he identified the beginning of that intention as being the first Chechen War in the 1990s, really the origin of this extremely brutal Islamic terrorism, which was initially directed against Russia. That, again, is something that LaRouche is famous for in his 1990s television program, Storm Over Asia, where he identified the first Chechen War as being the beginning of an attack on Russia, China, and India in particular, in order to destroy their sovereignty and, if possible, carry out some kind of revolutions and bring down their governments.
Well, Paul, you mentioned earlier that the oligarchs who are expecting this have their heads in the clouds, but they've been very active in promoting scenarios just in the last 24 hours. Reuters and others have been putting out stories of palace coup, military coup, overthrow of Putin. It'd be okay if a Russian nationalist coup took place as long as they supported the West. This is obviously an ongoing project from the people that Putin's identifying.
I think it should alarm us as Americans that we have financial leaders, so-called, who are in such a high-strung high-strung, hysterical state of mind that they think they're about to overthrow the Russian government tomorrow with these. And, you know, the other aspect of this is that the collapse in the oil price, which has put this great pressure on the Russian ruble, has put a great deal of pressure on a lot of other things as well. Many people don't know the Norwegian currency has collapsed. The Ukrainian currency, of course, not so much for oil reasons, but for reasons of just complete bankruptcy, is in total free fall. There are demonstrations all over Kiev against the central bank because of the collapse of its currency. The currencies of the sheikhdoms in the Middle East are also falling, and so are their stock markets very dramatically. There's something working here which could trigger a crash in the West, in the transatlantic area, in this collapse of the oil price.
And then there's been a dollar appreciation, hasn't there? What are the implications of that?
Well, that always there's always an inverse between the dollar and oil. And when QE, quantitative easing, was ended by the Fed, the dollar began to rise. And as it rose, the price of oil fell, but with very distinct, really rather public, steps taken by the Saudi royal family in the meanwhile to make sure that the fall in oil was rapid and deep.
Are the Saudis increasing their production?
They haven't decreased it, but what they did initially, as the dollar was appreciating back 2 months ago, what they did initially was to cut their prices while maintaining the same production. So the fact that they outright cut prices caused prices to start to fall across the board, and in that stage they went down to about $85 to the barrel. Now, of course, we're $30 below that because what began as a financial warfare weapon against Russia and probably also against Iran and perhaps against frackers in the U.S.
has Venezuela.
And Venezuela. That is, what began that way from the Saudi, British-Saudi standpoint, has become a kind of hand grenade bouncing around, potentially blowing up the high-yield credit markets in the transatlantic world and causing another crash. So this is a very complicated situation in which you are hearing only the great difficulties caused to Russia, but much, much more than that is going on and may be about to go on. And you have a much more determined leadership in Russia than you do, certainly, in Obama to deal with this.
You know, I had a discussion with a guy who runs a hedge fund in London the other day, and what he said is that people in Britain are crazy on this. He said Russia today is not the way it was in 1998 when there was a collapse of the bond market. He said Russia's credit situation is in much better shape right now. They have currency reserves, and they have an economy that is not shrinking as fast as the British economy. So I think that sort of parallels what you were just saying.
Russia's economy is in a this is an interesting historical point. It's in a somewhat similar situation to that of the United States when Abraham Lincoln took office at the outset of the Civil War. Russia has very little debt. We had very little debt at that time. Its ability to access international credit markets is very little, essentially zero. And that was true. That was what Lincoln confronted also when he started trying to raise money to fight the war. And it has also been strongly import-dependent in certain areas. And that had been the case in the 1850s when we gave up on our tariff system and we used the gold from California to buy imports in huge volumes. We became import-dependent in the same way. So Russia has a task to turn that around. And the famous greenback...
What did Lincoln do?
Well, the famous greenback policy. Essentially, Lincoln printed, since he did not have the ability to borrow, he printed the greenback currency as legal tender and borrowed it back. He printed it and distributed it among the population broadly in small denominations, and borrowed it back in a bond drive or a series of bond drives headed by Jay Cook, the banker. Again, borrowing it in small denominations so that the average American citizen could take part, and they did. And that began the revival of American credit, initially, obviously, in order to fight the war. But from the very beginning, Lincoln was doing other things as well in the steel industry, in the railroad industry, in the agricultural schools around the country, and so forth.
And this is an example of Hamiltonian credit.
Exactly. This is what LaRouche is fighting for right now, that this country has now we're talking the United States, which is not an idle bystander or a torturer in this particular case. We're not successfully torturing Putin or Russia, and we are in great danger of a collapse ourselves. What we need to do to contribute to the process of the BRICS countries, particularly the unbelievable China credit policy around the world, what we need to do is adopt the policies of Alexander Hamilton, which then puts us in the same process of generating national credit for high productivity infrastructure projects and collaborating with India, with China, with Egypt, with South Africa, and so forth, in order to make these projects work as fast as possible. Hamiltonian policy is exactly what our gift, I say this country's gift to the world was in the 19th century. Now we need to take that gift back and contribute it again, because the field is very fertile for it. It's essentially being done by China. It's being done by India. So we need to get back into that.
Well, and you mentioned both China and India in this. In the new LandBridge report that's just been produced, there's a section by you on this whole question of the Hamiltonian policy, but how this relates to the question of actual measurement of productivity. That is that they're not just generating credit to pay debt or for speculation, but they're investing it in areas which will increase the productive capacity of the population. I'd like you to just discuss that a little bit, because, look, this is a key problem. I talk to people all the time who say, well, China's got a problem. Their economy's starting to slow down. They don't have the ability to generate credit. Their credit is inflationary. But there's an obvious difference between what you're talking about as Hamiltonian credit and what the BRICS are doing, as opposed to what we've seen in the West with quantitative easing and 0% interest rates.
Right. We could certainly wish that we had the kind of slowing growth that China has, slowing from 7.5% to 7.4% a year. But let's take the United States first. people have to come to grips with the fact that conventional economists at this point, both of the Keynesian and of the Friedmanite variety, are completely wrong about what productivity is. They believe that productivity comes from a smaller amount of capital putting in motion a larger amount of labor in service industries. In other words, they believe it comes from labor intensivity. Now, the actual competent studies of productivity and what they call total factor productivity in the history of the United States are very clear on this, that by far the decades of highest productivity growth in the United States history were the 1930s and 40s. Now, these were not exactly decades of labor intensivity and austerity. These were decades in which there were tremendous directed credit investments in infrastructure. And the result was that, surprisingly, despite the war mobilization, productivity growth in the 30s, in the New Deal, was actually somewhat higher than in the 40s, than in the war mobilization of the 40s, even though it looked like everything was being transformed overnight during the war mobilization. That is called, by competent scholars the golden age of productivity in American history, and it goes through Kennedy's 1960s, and then it stops, then it collapses.
Paul, let me just to clarify a point to make it absolutely one which everyone on this call can get understand. The idea that you increase productivity through austerity, through cutting costs, which we've seen as the IMF model, it actually has the opposite effect, doesn't it?
Yes. I mean, look at Europe. I had an argument during the IMF meetings with one of the European Central Bank representatives, the one from France, Benoît Cœuré, who was insisting that their policy, that is the European Central Bank's policy, together with the bureaucracy in Brussels and so on, was to give a productivity shock to the European economies. And he even called it a total factor productivity shock, meaning high technological advance productivity. Yet, exactly the opposite continues to happen in Europe. There is no investment in infrastructure. There is no investment by small and medium businesses in technological progress. They can't get the credit to do it. They aren't doing it. And all they are doing is loaning huge amounts of money to banks which simply don't lend the money on. So their doctrine in this position of complete failure, their doctrine is to say, well, this is what productivity is. It's service economy. It's a large number of people being employed by a small amount of capital. And China, they say, and this is the real howler, China has given up on productivity since the 1990s, they claim, because of its pell-mell pursuit of investments in high-speed rail, airports, housing, water projects, nuclear power, and so on. It has given up on productivity. So, to a certain extent, these are people with diseased minds. It's hard to say what you can do with people.
But this is reflected. This is reflected, of course, in the view of what is GDP. Because, as you know, recently in the European Union, they're now counting up gambling, drug sales, and prostitution as part of GDP.
And it's the
I guess there's a. The speed up in the prostitution markets in Spain, I guess.
Yeah, that's the only way that they have avoided, in Europe as a whole, falling into the triple-dip recession. Although most of the countries have, a few of them have not, on the basis of exactly those including crime in the GDP. So this is China's path has been exactly what Roosevelt's path was and exactly what Lincoln's path was. China has created tremendous amounts of credit. People tend to harp on the fact that a certain amount of that credit has gone into housing speculation, for example, or commodity speculation, but no more than 10% of it has been rerouted that way, and that's been done largely by the actions of the banks in Hong Kong, which are, you know, the British banks operating through Hong Kong. And now, even as they are shrinking their housing bubble deliberately and shrinking their commodities speculation deliberately, they are strongly increasing at a tremendous pace their investment in power facilities, particularly nuclear power facilities, high-speed rail, which is rapidly crisscrossing the whole country, and they're talking about another 13,000 kilometers of it to be added in just the next 5 years within China, in addition to what they're building outside China by extending credit in other countries. So this is, you know, they're overcoming the effects of that speculation by the tremendous productivity increases involved in this kind of infrastructure investment. So we don't, they have just, by comparison, 8.5 to 9% of their GDP goes into infrastructure investment every year since 1992. So that's 22 years. The United States, 1.3% of our GDP goes into infrastructure investment, and it is still falling. It's literally scraping the bottom among industrial countries. So that's not Hamilton. Hamilton fought for the idea that the national debt was potentially a national blessing if you had the means to retire it, that credit was absolutely necessary to make an agricultural nation into a manufacturing nation, a technological nation, and that this bringing out of the skills of the and inventiveness of the individual citizen through the ability of that citizen to access credit in order to make his invention, to make his farm, to make his manufacturing business, that this was absolutely the American system, in Hamilton's view, in opposition to the British system. And that became the touchstone for American patriots all during the 19th century.
You're listening to Paul Gallagher from the Executive Intelligence Review, Economics and Financial Sector. To find more on this, you can go to the LaRouchePAC.com. One of the things that's just been produced by LaRouchePAC is a new pamphlet called Why the United States Must Join the BRICS, A New International Order for Mankind. And this is something that summarizes in a short form what we've also produced in a much longer special report, which you can order through EIR, Executive Intelligence Review, which is the full picture of the Eurasian land bridge. And what we've just been discussing with Paul is the section that he was responsible for producing in that land bridge report on this question of what is real productivity, what is real wealth. And Paul, let's just take that to the final level that LaRouche has been discussing for a long time, why it is that it's only at the frontiers of technology that you truly experience the real capacity for expansion of wealth based on human creativity. This is something that also comes from Hamilton, doesn't it?
Yes. As I was saying, Hamilton was very, in his report on manufacturers in particular, his report on the formation of a national bank, or his two reports on the national bank, were somewhat more technical. But in his report on manufacturing, he was very passionate about the fact that the inventive spirits, the creative spirits of the American people must be mobilized to make the country great, to make the country a manufacturing country on the scale, on the level of European countries and beyond it, beyond them, and that that credit, national credit, was key to this, because otherwise the only way in which someone could advance his own creativity or her own creativity in the course of a career was by painstakingly somehow building up savings to the point of being able to make a small investment in something, you know, the sort of retirement 401k model, which is not the means by which Henry Ford made the Model T, and it doesn't produce breakthroughs. So, you know, Hamilton said it is the responsibility of the government acting through a national bank, which it creates, to make sure that such credit is available and that it goes in the directions of the most creative inventions. At that time, particularly, he was concerned to invest in the first canals, which were really a dramatic change in productivity when you could move goods that quickly along canals in the interior of the country, canals and ports. That was Hamilton's whole thrust. And you can't separate infrastructure investments from productivity because, well obviously you can make mistaken infrastructure investment. You can build a wind farm in the middle of the West Texas, you know, wind plain.
Or the famous bridge to nowhere.
Well, the bridge to nowhere. You can make wind farms with no grids to bring the electricity anywhere. But if you actually are making these investments in tune with the advancements of science and the advancements of technology, then that is the means by which those technologies make their way into the economy more generally. They begin by being used. I mean, we have no better example than in NASA, which was the last really, the Apollo project was really the last great infrastructure project that this country has had, and that was almost 60 years ago now. And if you look at the curve of the budget of the space agency, it collapsed almost immediately. It had collapsed by the time we landed on the moon. There was almost nothing left of the NASA budget by the time we first actually landed on the moon. So, and, you know, it has been a tenth of what it was ever since then in real terms. But that was a big infrastructure project. That's real transportation, transportation to the rest of the solar system. And it was the way in which so many different advanced technologies first made their way into the economy was through that infrastructure investment. And that's the nature of it. That's why productivity advanced so quickly in those decades in which we were making the strongest infrastructure investment. So what they say about China is absolutely wrong. What China is doing both internally and in extending credit across Africa and South America and now in Central Europe, where they're they're really connecting Central Europe to the Mediterranean for the first time with rail links and real connectivity between the middle of Central Europe and the Mediterranean Sea and the Suez Canal. What they're doing with these things is opening up a potentially, they call it win-win, you know, which is a simple way of putting it, but a potentially mutually beneficial effort by the nations of the world as a whole. And the United States obviously needs to get in that with Hamiltonian methods and Hamiltonian credit and compete with China in order to see which can cause the greatest benefit for mankind in this way.
Well, you just anticipated my next question because, as you know, we've been holding, the Schiller Institute has been holding conferences around. Can you hear me, Paul? Hello?
Hello?
Paul, did you lose me?
Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
All right, George, you'll have to cut a little bit of that out. But I was just saying you anticipated my next question, which is that we've been holding Schiller Institute conferences around the world, really, but also in the United States, to discuss this idea of the U.S. joining the BRICS. And I'd like to ask you the question that always comes up, how would the U.S. participate in the BRICS process?
By forming a national bank. It really requires that. You either have to form a national, we, the country, the government, the Congress, has to either form a national bank or a corporation like the RFC or like the European Reconstruction and Development Corporation, what we call the Marshall Plan Corporation, in order to extend credit. In other words, you can't just, that's what's necessary.
Would that make the United States then part of the new development bank? Is that the way one of the ways we would participate?
That's the most efficient way because then you're having joint capitalization of those banks. We're speaking of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, the AIIB, which is going into operation sometime this year with 22 countries, I think, led by China, and the new development bank, the so-called BRICS Bank, going into operation by the end of the year with partnership of the five BRICS countries. Those can become very big international development banks with capitalization from the United States. Obviously, we potentially, because our currency is the world reserve currency at the moment, and our debt, which is quite large, is also funded and trusted, and therefore we can create a great deal of credit to capitalize a bank like this. We can do so just by reorganizing some of our existing treasury debt. That's how Hamilton did it, was by a reorganization of the debt outstanding, which at that time the colonies and the government were having a very hard time paying it. We don't have that disadvantage now, and we could certainly reorganize, say, $1 trillion worth of the $13 trillion worth of publicly held U.S. debt into a bank such that we could capitalize these banks to that degree. So it's not at all difficult to do, but it's the same step required to create national credit in the United States is also necessary in order to cooperate with what China, India, and these other countries are already doing with their development banks.
Now, once we would do that, we would obviously then be generating credit internally for projects such as the high-speed rail lines in the United States, the Bering Strait Tunnel, ways of connecting through South and Central America. But also, would there be a means by which the U.S. firms would be able to participate in the great projects that are outlined in the special Landridge report?
Well, sure. I mean, this is the method. If you go back to the Marshall Plan, that was basically an extension of credit indirectly through European countries to American companies, which got the contracts and provided the means of reconstruction of Europe and were paid directly by the U.S. credits. So this will happen again. These banks and a U.S. national bank for this purpose will be able to discount, say, by 50% loans that any other banks make to companies that want to participate, so that you can get a very large number of companies borrowing from their own banks, where those banks are able to borrow back from the national bank, say, 50% of what they loan to the company, and that discounting gets everybody participating in the issuance of credit and in the production. But, of course, this country has lost so much of its productive capability that it's not clear how much of that we'll be able to do. We can't build high-speed trains. We don't have a single company that builds train sets anywhere in the United States. We have one company that builds locomotives, and no companies that build the train sets. We can't build nuclear plants. We don't have the only company which formerly did that is Westinghouse, and that's a Japanese company. There are many, many of the needs of infrastructure which we have, which we've lost. So,
I mean, this is such a big change. I was thinking the other day about the 1876 U.S. Centennial Exhibition, where the world was taken aback at the locomotive production and the steam engines that we were producing. And now it seems as though if we're going to have high-speed rail systems, they're going to have to be built by the Chinese.
Well, yeah. I mean, there are other countries that build those train sets. Spain, for example, is one of the leaders internationally in building high-speed rail locomotives and tractions, as they call them, and train sets. But China has recently taken the technology to further advances, probably is best at it now. But that's only a very recent development. But we're definitely, I mean, this is the impact of spending 1.3% of our GDP on infrastructure year after year. We're nowhere in terms of this kind of building. So we need the Hamiltonian gift of credit in order to recapture that industrial economy which we used to be.
Now, Paul, I'd like to shift to the other thing I mentioned at the very beginning, which was this fight in the House and Senate this last week over a change, perhaps the one part of the Dodd-Frank bill that had any merit, and even that's questionable. But I'd like you to just give a report to our listeners on what happened, and especially the kind of alliances that we saw in defense of the speculative economy, which included, of course, President Obama.
Well, it was a shocking series of developments which really opened up the potential for different behavior in Congress when they come back next year and for an improvement. Because the Dodd-Frank Act, which has been a very kind of fraught act all along because the Democrats have felt themselves required to dance around defending this act. They know very well they should have passed Glass-Steagall, restored Glass-Steagall, but they didn't, because Wall Street was opposed, Obama was opposed, Barney Frank and other operatives were opposed. So they did this instead, and they've tried to defend it since then as an effectively an infinite series of regulations, half measures, long delayed measures, and so on. And then suddenly, 2 or 3 weeks ago, excuse me, Wall Street just ran roughshod over the Congress and said, the hell with this act. There's a part of it we don't like. We're taking it out. And, you know, once they've put the money into your campaign and put the money into your office and your coffers, then these congressmen find it hard to say no, which is why the Financial Services Committee, for example, in the House, a very big committee, all or nearly every single one of them voted for this spending bill with this poison pill in it, because they get so much in the way of money.
So what does this provision do that was put into the bill?
Well, it said that there, when Dodd-Frank was being passed, there was an amendment to it put up by Senator Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas. She's no longer in the Senate. And that said that banks had to take their derivatives dealing operations and spin them out into not separate corporations, but separate units, which would have some capital of their own, and deal with derivatives outside their commercial banks and outside their holding company.
So, and the money that these units would have would not be depositors' money or something that's protected under the FDIC.
Correct, although nothing really prevented the banks, which had the commercial banks, which had the deposit base, from lending money to these derivatives units. So it was porous. But it was put forward at that time as, well, this is the best we can do. It's almost like Glass-Steagall. And there was a big fight, and her amendment passed in the Senate. But Obama was against it, and Barney Frank killed it in the Senate House conference. And instead they put in what's called Section 716 of Dodd-Frank, and that just says that instead of having to push out all derivatives operations into these separate units, you only have to push out a small fraction of them, namely commodity derivatives and what they call uncleared credit default swaps. Maybe a total between those two of $45 trillion in nominal value of exposure had to go into these separate units. And that meant that if those units failed, there was no FDIC backstop for them. They were not part of the insured commercial banks. So the banks simply rode roughshod over the Congress and said, you know, you have to pass this funding bill, so we're putting, they wrote it, Citibank wrote it, we're putting a repeal of this provision in the funding bill, and you've got to pass it, because we don't like to have to do these are the riskiest of all derivatives. We don't like to have to do these outside FDIC insurance where the taxpayer would back them up. Mm-hmm. So there was a huge fight once a few members of the Senate Banking Committee began to fight. It spread. This was initially Elizabeth Warren, Merkley of Oregon, Sherrod Brown of Ohio, Carl Levin. Once they began to fight, it spread, and it spread into the House, which is very unusual, where you have actually senators organizing members of the House in their party to beat down something, and they came within about a dozen votes of defeating this entire funding bill, because it had this obvious recipe for another taxpayer bailout of derivatives collapse.
Now, is this 12 votes in the Senate or the House?
In the House.
Mm-hmm.
I think, if I remember, in the Senate, the vote was something like 55-45. But the House was the big battle. And by the time it got to the Senate, if they had not passed it, since the House had gone out of session, if they had not passed it, then the government would have come to a halt because there was no means of providing a funding bill for it. So it was very, very impossible for the Senate to vote this thing down. Their whole drive earlier, days earlier, had been to defeat it in the House. And that's when, just when they seemed to be approaching a threshold where these senators and some members of the House, like Maxine Waters and others, were getting close to the threshold of defeating, not defeating the funding bill, but forcing the Republicans to take the repeal of this derivatives provision out of it so that they could then vote on it. That's when President Obama jumped into the fray with a press conference saying that he wanted this bill passed, and he began to call legislators, mainly Democrats, and it quickly became known that the head of that criminal operation known as J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, was also directly calling members of the House and Senate.
And I think the way Maxine Waters put it was quite useful. She said, Obama and Jamie Dimon are whipping our members in the House.
That's right. And they were. And that's what got it through. And now this is no small matter because commodity derivatives include energy derivatives, and that's where the oil collapse, the oil price collapse, is getting ready to take down a lot of what they call high-yield debt in the energy sector and outside it. You know, you're talking about $2.5 trillion worth of high-yield debt in the American financial system, what we sometimes call junk debt, but they like to call it high-yield. Makes it sound better.
That goes back to Michael Milken.
Yes, right. And this collapse in oil is taking this debt down, and there's plenty of commodity derivatives piled on top of that, exposure piled on top of that debt, which could go. And it appears that it's concentrated in some banks, like Morgan Stanley, that could be slammed by what's now spreading out of the fall in the oil price. So if they are slammed, the Congress has been made to vote through a provision which says that they'll be bailed out by the FDIC. And this is no small matter because the FDIC was used to bail out the money market mutual funds in 2008 before any other bailouts took place, well, after the nationalization of Fannie and Freddie. But before other bailouts took place, it was the FDIC that was made to give its guarantee to money market mutual funds, which had nothing to do with commercial banks. And they, in the 6 years, they've never been able to get rid of that since. So the FDIC is still guaranteeing those speculative operations. This would, you know, the FDIC is not, it operates on the basis of a credit line from the Treasury, and that means taxpayer money. So they built in this bailout. Elizabeth Warren drove that point home in some real Jeremy ads that she gave on the floor of the Senate. And when they come back, it's going to be a very sensitive situation that some members of Congress themselves have called perhaps a Glass-Steagall moment. Because now the Lincoln Amendment, which was just like Glass-Steagall or almost as good, was gone. Then came this Section 17, which was supposed to be almost as good as the Lincoln Amendment. Now that's gone. Now in the last couple of days, they've announced, the Fed has announced that the Volcker Rule will also be delayed by an additional year. That was supposed to be just as good as Glass-Steagall. So they're running roughshod over these fake Glass-Steagall regulations.
And I also read that the American Banking Association is planning an offensive to get rid of the rest of Dodd-Frank, which they say is too many regulations, too restrictive. So it looks like the whole thing is about to be tossed.
They think that this model worked, they'll do it again. But the model worked to generate a tremendous anti-Wall Street backlash in the Congress and to a certain extent in the American people. So it may not work again. It may have worked to create a Glass-Steagall moment, and if they keep pushing and tearing down more of these millions of regulations, then it may cause the Congress to go back and say, well, let's get some other legislation instead. Let's do Glass-Steagall instead.
Well, and this then would fit in with this whole question that we were talking about in the first two-thirds of the program, that we actually are at a point where we could begin to put together the Hamiltonian credit system, Glass-Steagall, where the United States could participate with the BRICS.
Well, yeah, you know, Glass-Steagall plays a very important role in that because it's part of the process of getting commercial banks to resume their lending to really productive activity. This took a long time in the 1930s, even after the government was creating all the demand and all the progress. It took a long time for the banks to begin to participate again by making loans. So if we're going to create national credit, we have to, as I was explaining before, we have to have our banks participating. Otherwise, any company that wants to get involved in rebuilding the world, so to speak, has to deal directly with the government and be a federal contractor. It shouldn't really be that way. They have to also borrow from the government in order to do it. It shouldn't really be that way. You know, we need the banks participating. And that's the way we've always made progress in the past. So, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just, we're down to about 7 or 8 minutes, and I just wanted to bring something up that really caught my attention this morning. I just read an updated report that said that of the fines that have been levied against the big banks, and it's somewhere larger than $30 billion in total fines.
Oh, much more. 80.
Yeah.
80.
But how much is it?
On the order of $80 billion, yeah.
But that the big banks can deduct up to 75% of the fines as tax deductions.
That's right. They're losses. So
so they're just counting the fines as if they were losses.
Correct.
And where's the justice, Paul?
Well, that's in Eric Holder's Hot Little Lambs, and you know the Holder dogma, the Holder doctrine was, it's dangerous to prosecute a bank. It could cause the financial system to go haywire.
Which, of course, it's going to, as these, you mentioned the oil situation. A lot of people are saying, well, can we make profits if the oil price is below $60 in terms of the production in the Eagle Ford and the Bakken fields? But it's not even the question of can you make profits. It's that you have this huge speculative bubble that's been leveraged on top of the expected profits that were there to pay the loans. So we are headed for a big blowout, aren't we?
Yeah, they've been leveraged on top of a new type of oil sector, which is very inefficient. You know, it gets so much hype, fracking, as if it were, you know, the newest way of getting to Mars or something like that. But it's very inefficient. Fracking wells give out usually within a year to two, whereas wells drilled in conventional fields can produce for 50 years. And so a fracking company has to drill continuously in order to continue to produce. That means they have to borrow a tremendous amount of money. They have to take a tremendous amount of credit, and that has been known as high-yield credit because they are very leveraged companies. And so they're in that sector, what's called leveraged debt, and they have to keep borrowing, and right now they can't. It's already been the case that the what they call the spreads, how much higher the interest rate is on a loan to a company like that as opposed to a company like General Electric, is went from 4% to more than 10%. It's almost 11% now. So at that elevated interest rate, they just really can't borrow. There's no liquidity for them there, and so they've had to stop. And once they stop drilling, you can figure out the rest for yourself, and you have all of that derivatives exposure sitting on top of that. So,
well, it seems to me you could have something like a margin call, that if these companies are not able to produce enough income to cover their loans, then banks are going to go to them and say, you've got to pay this. And at that point, it risks the whole leverage bubble, right?
It does. I mean, it seemed to me from the beginning of this oil drop a while ago that either the price is going to snap back up in the first part of 2015. You're going to see suddenly the price running way back up again. Or there is likely to be a crash in that sector. And the question is, how big? You know, that sector is not as big as the mortgage sector that melted down. For example, it's about a fifth as big. But nonetheless, very big. It's $2.5 trillion and of high-yield credit, and could blow up unless the price really snaps back up. And, you know, with the dollar rising, that's very unlikely. So watch out.
Well, so while we were talking about the collapse of Russia, Venezuela, and other countries, and actually one of the points Mr. LaRouche was making is that the people running these operations are bluffing because their own system is bankrupt.
Yes, it's a very complicated situation in which they've provoked bankruptcy in a system which is already bankrupt. They've tried to direct it at a particular country for geopolitical reasons, but they've unleashed a potential crash. It's a situation they can't necessarily control.
Well, and that's where we are, and that's why I think it's really critical that our listeners order copies of this new pamphlet, the pamphlet Why the United States Must Join the BRICS. That's released by LaRouche PAC. You can contribute to LaRouche PAC. You can call your organizer and ask them for as many copies as you need. But it's important that you then organize people to read it and discuss it and become promoters of this idea. Also, the EIR special report on the land bridge, the Eurasian land bridge, or the world land bridge, that's available as well, and that gives you much more of an in-depth background along the lines of what we've been talking with Paul about on this program today. Paul, do you have any last words of wisdom in the last minute here?
No. Well, I think what I was saying is watch out in terms of this attempt to bring down Russia by collapsing the oil, by the, what they call the oil sanction. I would say watch out. But, you know, we have the process going which is more important here, which is the process of developing citizens around the idea of Hamilton's economic policies and Hamilton's industrial policies and credit policies so that they can remake their government into something decent that we'd like to have and that would actually compete with China and India and the other countries for the benefit of the world. That's what we need to do. We have this petition, which we've just publicized because it reached more than 100 prominent individuals calling on governments to stop the sanctions provocations against Russia and get on with the work of what the BRICS have begun. And that petition also needs to be circulated for many thousands more signatures, prominent or not, as part of this drive. So, you know, we have that process going, and I think we should be confident that it will work.
Well, we have to win back our country, and that's the real issue here. So, Paul, thank you for joining us today and for making it through despite being somewhat under the weather. And for those listening, we'll be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time for the next issue of The LaRouche Show.